the story of Christ's turning of the water into wine at the wedding of Cana inspires some hefty and rather eviscerating existential questions. The first one is the most relevant, but I'm moving towards the second and the third. Christ was immediately asked by his mother to provide for the wine which had run out of the wedding reception. And personally, I've probably attended 425 wedding receptions as a minister in the last 40 years, and it's a familiar and psychically bruising scenario. Now, you obviously don't know my style yet, but I speak with heavy irony. What his mother required him to do was to provide for the fact that the wine had run out. And Jesus rather brusquely addressed her in the following terms. Verse 4, "A woman, what have you to do with me?" Now, the first kind of query in this short sermon is the question, are you afraid of your mother? It's, by the way, the most important question I could ask some of you. It trumps even God because it lives with you. And Christ displays what therapists call a differentiated personality or temperament or formation here that is really quite astounding. You know that his mother was right because they had run out of wine. And moms are usually right. But the way they go about lecturing us is usually mistaken because it forces young men to go very far away, like that place we talked about, Jackson Hole. Almost all of the young people of Birmingham, Alabama, where I served for many years, spend a stint in Jackson Hole. Now, even though she was right, he rejected domineering personalities, and especially his mom, and I think this is very wonderful. So again, I ask you, are you afraid of your mother? Or, to put it in a slightly bigger context, are you afraid of anybody with whom you live? I think you would be amazed how frightened people can be of their spouses. Women can be scared out of their wits by men who raise their voices. And today, men are generally the shoes on the other foot, are intimidated by the men are intimidated. And your sons, by the way, are completely intimidated. That's why they're all watching video games 12 hours a day at Vanderbilt. Now, I'm still having a little problem your understanding the way I work, but the question that Jesus raises is the question of the differentiated personality, and it's an enormously impressive disposition that he's given. Would that we could both acknowledge the truth of what our mothers were saying, but in a way that smacked of transcendence and independence. Now, the second eviscerating, gut-wrenching question arises from the next thing that we hear in verse 9, where we read that the water had now become wine. Christ responded to this necessary requirement of a successful party to have good wine throughout the concluding part of the party by changing it into wine. Now, the thing about our lives is that if you really want to make any progress as a person, you've got to change everything. Now, I don't mean circumstantially. You don't have to change your loved ones. You can't do that. You'd like to, but you can't. But you are aware, I feel sure, that so many of us are in kind of box canyons of decisions we made many years ago. And we really are looking to change our lives. And the great issue of the New Testament is the question of how can a man enter into his mother's womb and be born again? Because there is this tremendous inner compulsion that we all have to start over again. And this is really what I'm offering you in the sermon. I'm offering you a kind of perspective on what it would mean to truly start over again in lives that tend to be hedged about by previous decisions and all kinds of constraints and DNA and genetics and compulsive psychological patterns and you name it that people are caught in. And Christ noticed this. He doesn't change the water into better water. He changes it into something completely different. Now, give me a minute and I'll explain how this works. I was recently in Publix. This is the big grocery chain where we live. And have you noticed about bottled water? They all say it's spring water, but it's not spring water. It's treated tap water to make it taste like spring water. They even say it now. If you look carefully, this is not spring water. It's treated tap water. So is this what we're supposed to do in our lives? To treat what we've got to make it look a little different? Do you remember that cartoon in The New Yorker in the 80s when a fella is being thrown out of a bar and he's landed, having been thrown out of the bar, and he's landed on his back, and he says, "All I did was order a wine spritzer." Well, Lee, help me out here. Y'all get used to it. Y'all get used to it. Obviously, this is fresh. What we're talking about in life is we're not talking about a wine spritzer or Perrier. We're talking about an entirely different kind of being that is based on an awareness of the real facts of tragedy, impasse, and devastation before we die, so that we can live a life based on love, sacrifice, hopefulness, not out of our own resources, which have been destroyed by circumstance, but out of the resources that are eternal of the Holy Ghost. I was fascinated to read that Claire Booth Luce had a connection with Nashville. Now, she's a person that no one today has ever heard about, Claire Booth Luce. But in the 50s, she was probably the most famous woman in America. And she was on the cover of Time magazine, of which her husband was the publisher. And she was an astonishingly successful, brilliant public persona. And she went to college, by the way, in this city. And she caused a furore in the late 1940s when this highly sophisticated, extremely, so to speak, rich, fashionable woman became a Roman Catholic. Now, does anyone here know why Claire Booth Luce became a Roman Catholic? Well, had you lived in 1950, everybody in America knew about it. No problem, we don't live in 1950, but she's fascinating. And people got furious. It just shows you that the media hasn't changed in its perspective on religion. People went bananas when Claire Booth Luce became a Roman Catholic. And everything in her life, as she saw it, fundamentally altered in 1944, and she went on not treated water, but her water of her life was turned to wine. Well, do you know why this happened? People would say, oh, she just got religion. People do not get religion. They get hit by a 2x4. Claire Booth Luce had one daughter. She went to Stanford University in Palo Alto. And her daughter was killed in a car crash. And this was the decisive event of Claire Booth Luce's adult life, against which everything was water and nothing had any meaning whatsoever. And she became, in her case, a very high-profile and devout Roman Catholic. What am I saying by that? You and I know that our need for something new and something transcendent is because we're in trouble. We're highly vulnerable. We are all dying. I've been emptying cocktail parties and dinner parties for 40 years by bringing up the subject of death. Nothing will work. It's commonly called a room emptier. And people will, even people my age today, who are closer to death than I might have been 40 years ago, as soon as I bring up the subject, they'll say, well, what are you doing these days? Well, I'm devoting 24/7, 365 days a year, to preparing for my own death. Well, that's a real great conversation starter. Somebody say, well, how's the weather? And very soon, but you know what the funny thing is? You say it, and everyone leaves, and then about 25 minutes later, you can't keep them away. Because deep down, everybody here knows that it is coming. And it involves the extinction of the ego life of me. And it involves something that is massively important as well as threatening. So I need something new. Now, this is not a three-point sermon because I'm now going to give you the real point, if possible. I talked about self-differentiation with moms. And this, by the way, I could speak for 25 Sundays on that subject, and it is an enormously issue of attachment with children. But what I'm really aiming for is to ask you to talk and to think a little bit about the newness that you crave and how it is to be achieved. And this is my sort of last point. As far as the ego is concerned, that's to say the person that you are, irrespective of God, the person that gets up in the morning and is defensive, the person that's anxious, the person that's driving in the car, the person that's worried about your children and your grandchildren, the person that is constantly competing for some kind of inner advantage or outward advantage. As far as that person is concerned, and everyone here is related to that person, life is trending down. Life is trending down. It's not trending up. You can say all you want about, I'm just a cockeyed optimist from South Pacific, but from the ego's point of view, there is nothing to be optimistic about. You're getting older. Your hair, you know, my hair turned prematurely, as I saw it, white over a space of 3 months during a professional crisis. I had no history of early white hair in my male antecedents, and it turned prematurely white over a three-month period of a professional crisis, as I saw it. Another man I knew, his hair turned white in 24 hours. After he failed to guard a grandchild while babysitting, and the child died in a swimming pool. And I saw the man's hair turn white in a space of 24 hours. Now, what I'm getting at is that from the standpoint of the ego, life is trending down. I've spent so much time in hospital rooms with people after heart surgery over the years, and I often see a kind of look of intense fear on the part of people who are in major recovery from major surgery. They are intensely panicked, and it comes across. I'll quote Christopher Isherwood, who wrote very powerfully to me. He said almost everybody he knew in Hollywood who was dying died with puzzlement and resentment. He was at Charles Laughton's deathbed. He was with Cary Grant near the time. He knew everybody who was anybody, and he watched them. And he said, almost everybody I knew was suffering from puzzlement and resentment. And the purpose of this sermon is to give you the antidote to puzzlement and resentment so that you could live a life that was trending upward and had the chance of being something new. And let me just say what those two things are. The two great antidotes to human existence seen as a trending down because of physical degeneration are a belief that the universe is friendly rather than malignant, and a conviction that mercy is possible. And now I'm going to finish. The first view is actually what the atheists today, they're simply wrong because they've not put themselves in a position to see that the universe is in fact friendly when we stay quiet enough to let him speak with a friendly voice. I see it again and again. And when you realize that the universe is in fact friendly and in fact wants to bless you rather than to scourge you, that is enormously fructifying. Now, let me give you an example. Do you all know Scott Walker? Well, Scott Walker was the lead singer of a rock group in England called the Walker Brothers. They were the righteous brothers of England, although none of them were English and none of them had Walker in their names. They were massively successful in the 60s. Scott Walker, Make It Easy on Yourself, The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore. Scott Walker is one of the very few rock artists to have a 50-year career. And he just released a new album, and he's a genius. He's an inspired man, Scott Walker. And he just released his new album. And they said, "What's with you that you have such a creative, continuing, happy, fruitful experience in your 70s. And this is what Scott Walker said to the Manchester Guardian in November. He said, "I'm not a religious person, but..." Now, whenever anyone says, "I'm not a religious person, but..." what are they saying? "I'm a religious person, but I don't want to say it." Scott Walker said, "I'm not a religious person, but there's a longing." The interviewer said, "For what?" Scott Walker said, "It's a longing for a purpose. It is just a feeling that it might be there." The interviewer, "Can we all find this purpose?" "Oh yes, I believe so," said Walker. "We just need to find enough silence and stillness to experience it." Well, I want to end by saying first that the universe is friendly, and if you can just pipe down long enough to receive it, it's on your side. It's not malignant, although your ego understands it to be malignant. And the second thing about universe is it's forgiving. And this is where the great power of the Christian faith comes to us. Did you read USA Today yesterday? Father Murray, or is it Father Martin? I think it's Father Murray, who is Stephen Colbert's great friend. In the front page article on forgiveness, he's a wonderful man. He's a Catholic priest. And he actually said something Christian that was on the front page of USA Today. All the copies had been burned. But he said, "You have to understand," we have a hard time forgiving, but for me as a priest, the essence of the Christian faith is forgiving 70 times 7. The essence of the Christian faith. And when I met people like Isherwood did in the hospital who were partly puzzled by their own incipient demise, and secondly, profoundly remorseful about their first wife or about the way they treated their daughter, profoundly filled with tremendous guilt, usually about things left undone, I discovered that the great antidote to the human trappedness is first the conviction that God is friendly and that he will forgive anything when it is surfaced. So I leave that with you. I sort of think you're a little bit like the character in The Incredible Shrinking Man. He was trapped in the 1956 masterpiece. He was trapped in a spider's web in the body of a fly, but his own head, and a spider was approaching him. And he said, "Help! That movie is shown once a week on the Turner Classic Movie Channel. And it's extraordinary picture of the human condition. I'm trapped in the body of an insect, and I'm threatened, and I can't do anything to help myself. No wonder I die puzzled and remorseful. But you don't have to. And I hope that you'll maybe, you know, tonight give it a whirl, sort of listening to the good that is actually coming your way. And also you'll hear again the great words of our communion service, that Christ Jesus came into the world not to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. As I said at Woodstock years ago, thank you very much.